Every year, malaria kills over 1 million people, or one child every 30 seconds. Although the disease is devastating, particularly in Africa, it is preventable and treatable. Joining me for this week's Please Explain to discuss malaria are Dr. Peter Agre, who is a Nobel laureate and director of the Johns Hopkins Malaria Research Institute, and John MacArthur, Chief Executive Officer and Executive Director of Millennium Promise. I'm very pleased to welcome them to the show. Hi.
You want to sit down?
Hi, thanks for having us.
John, what's the mission of your organization, Millennium Promise?
Millennium Promise is committed to the achievement of the Millennium Development Goals, which are the international targets for tackling extreme poverty in its many forms by 2015, of which malaria is very much at the top of the agenda.
Malaria is caused by poverty or causes poverty?
Cause and consequence. Malaria has a deep effect, particularly in the areas where there's an ecological basis for the disease, such as sub-Saharan Africa, where it slows down growth dramatically, it increases child mortality, it cuts into education rates. It's just got enormous consequences. But also, those places are so poor that they can't afford the basic interventions needed to get it under control.
Now, there are other poor places and hot places around the world. Why is 90% of all malaria in sub-Saharan Africa?
Well, there are several types of malaria and types of the parasite, and the worst type is falciparum malaria, which is the one that really kills people. And it is carried by the Anopheles mosquito, which bites people in a higher rate in Africa than in other parts of the world. In South Asia, for example, tends to bite cattle more often than people. So you then have a reproductive rate and transmission rate that's affected by the temperature, the mosquito, and then the disease burden itself is affected by the type of parasite, which is the most lethal in Africa.
So we're spared partly, even in the hottest parts of the United States, because we just don't have the right kind of mosquito?
Well, we actually had malaria in the southern part of the Mississippi Delta and so forth up to the beginning of the last century and even through the middle parts of the last century. But that was actually a different type of malaria, and it was eradicated through a lot of basic interventions. It was never the type and severity of malaria as we have in Africa today, but some very practical measures got it under control, and we could be doing the same in Africa.
Peter, you received the 2003 Nobel Prize for Chemistry for your discovery of aquaporins, a family of water channel proteins. Has your study of aquaporins been extended to malarial research?
Yes. The aquaporins are something we've been working on for quite some time. It's basically these are the plumbing systems of cells. We can move water throughout our bodies to make spinal fluid, tears, sweat, concentrate our urine. And there are some members of this family that move glycerol. Glycerol is, of course, a viscous fluid. And the Plasmodium falciparum and the other Plasmodia species each have an aqua glyceroporin. So it's part of this protein family. And when we did simple biological experiments knocking them out, we were able to show that the organism is less invasive. So our inroads into malaria are through the aquaporins. But honestly, Leonard, I have had a lifelong interest in this topic. I've never had an opportunity to work on it. So this is all since the Nobel. This is a new adventure for me.
Well, it is a matter of curiosity how an American institution, Johns Hopkins, would wind up doing research on a disease that's quite rare in this country. Is there comparable malaria research being done in Africa?
Well, of course, Africa is a poor continent. And while they do have universities, they have nothing similar to what we have here in the United States. And on a research basis, the interest in malaria, of course, by African scientists, is very large, but the ability to pursue that at a basic level is very limited. So we have the resources here. And I think the American people are big-hearted. The Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health has always been looking for diseases that affect the least fortunate on the planet.
And malaria is one of the diseases that is devastating Africa. HIV/AIDS, dengue fever. Are all of these connected in some way? Do we find people who are HIV positive also more likely to get malaria?
Yeah.
Or vice versa?
You made an important point here, because those who are most at risk, of course, are highly vulnerable because they're very poor, oftentimes malnourished, and oftentimes very young. So the youngsters don't have the native immunity that adults who've withstood periodic infections will have. So, in fact, it's not at all rare for an individual to be HIV positive and become infected with malaria and then maybe develop drug-resistant TB and a diarrheal disease. They oftentimes, these multiple illnesses will appear in unfortunate individuals. And in Africa is where the poverty is the most striking on the planet.
John suggested these diseases are one of the reasons that Africa remains poor, because it cuts down on progress. If people are dealing with something on such a basic level, they can't then deal with other things. My guests are Dr. Peter Agre, who's a Nobel laureate, director of the Johns Hopkins Malaria Research Institute, and John MacArthur, chief executive officer and executive director of Millennium Promise. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. John, what are the local perceptions of malaria in Africa?
I think it's obviously dramatically different in different parts of Africa, where you have endemic burdens or epidemic, where it rises and falls at different times of year and in different seasons. And what you often see, remarkably, is that this is a disease that has been with us for probably thousands and thousands of years. The genetic evidence for it is extremely strong. The markers, things like sickle cell anemia in West Africa, are extremely strong. And it's been there for so long that it's actually, in many cases, just become part of the backdrop. And you see people talk about fever, for example, in communities where that's just what malaria is fever, especially among the adult populations. But at the same time, you also see, of course, with child mortality so high, you have one in six, one in eight children not making it to their fifth birthday with malaria, often the single largest factor causing that high, enormous rate of mortality, that parents and families are so excited to take practical actions against this terrible disease. So we've seen the introduction in the past few years, at last, of long-lasting insecticide-treated nets. We have tens of millions of families just so excited that the most basic thing is now becoming available so that they can sleep two children under a net, and that is making a dramatic difference on mortality already. And we've seen in the past couple of years in countries like Ethiopia, Rwanda, Kenya, mortality dropping by half or two-thirds among families that are using it. And this is a real sense of inspiration in those communities.
Well, a listener wants to know how many deaths from malaria have been caused by the ban on DDT, because that's what wiped out malaria in the south of the United States, isn't it?
Well, there was a lot of, I'm not an expert on what happened in the South, but the DDT was a piece of that. Drainage, environmental management was a part of that, because the malaria often breeds in pools of water, of course. But you've seen that there was a ban on DDT. That ban is now generally being lifted. The World Health Organization has endorsed it for something called indoor residual spraying. It's basically spraying once or twice a year inside the walls of households, not in the fields, not in the crops, keeping it out of the food system. And we're seeing that this is a very low-cost, highly effective tool in the arsenal of tools, which includes medicine, bed nets, spraying, and basic environmental management to keep those pools limited so that the mosquitoes can't breed in the tires around Africa, for example.
I want to go back in a little while to some of these preventive measures. But, Peter, I'd like to know about malaria itself. John said that it goes back thousands of years. Is it even more ancient than that? Does it predate humans, or
sure,
does it come along with humans?
Well, you're right on target here. The this genus has been around forever. There are members of the malaria, different species of Plasmodia that affect reptiles and birds, other mammals. So, in fact, this parasite has been around for a very long time. Humans are affected, and each of these appears to be a specific species. So human malaria has a related disease in mice, but it's not the same organism.
And what is it? Is it a virus? Is it some kind of bacterium?
This is a unicellular eukaryote. That means it's a unicellular organism like a bacteria, but more advanced. It's more like a yeast or a more advanced organism. It has a nucleus. It has organelles. Bacteria are simpler, but it's a unicellular microscopic organism that lives within cells.
So it's genetically complex. How does it develop in the mosquito? It develops inside the mosquito, doesn't it?
Well, the lifestyle or the life cycle of this is complicated, and it lives in mosquitoes where it has negative consequences, and it also then the mosquitoes will pass the infection to humans where the second part of the life cycle occurs. So it's going back and forth. And without humans or without mosquitoes, the parasite can't exist. So the mosquito phase is one place where we're looking for basic developmental biology for pathways which might be useful to manipulate the insects.
Well, let me see if I understand this. The mosquito bites the human. The human becomes infected. Another mosquito comes along and bites a human, and now the mosquito becomes infected?
That's right. So the
And then that bites another human, and we go back and forth.
Yes, and of course the parasite has multiple different life forms. It goes through an asexual phase of reproduction, then a sexual phase, and so the mosquitoes pick this up from humans and transfer it to another human, but not immediately. It's after a couple of weeks of life within the mosquito itself, so it's complicated, that makes it very difficult to eradicate. I mean, if you got rid of all of the mosquitoes that carry the infection, of course that would be fine, but that's almost impossible. On the other hand, when we had malaria here in the United States, it was actually prevalent throughout the United States. My home state of Minnesota had malaria up till about the year 1900.
I always thought that it needed heat.
Well, it's more active when it's warmer. On the other hand, the organism can still live in mosquitoes at lower temperatures. But of course, with global warming, malaria is moving to environments where it has not been active recently. But it was active in the United States, and the eradication within the U.S. was something that took place before DDT. It was the public health measures, the draining of swamps, the development of screens, public health measures of that sort.
Well, I want to get back to how this whole thing works. So we have this very complex parasite. It's now been injected into my body, and it goes to my liver?
That's right.
Why the liver, and why isn't the body's immune system able to destroy it?
Well, both good questions. We should get you in our laboratory here. The liver is the first place where the infection occurs, and the organism then will grow and divide and release many sporozoites. That's the term for the next phase of the infection, which will spread to red blood cells, where it then grows and divides ever so much more rapidly. So the malarial fevers are often coincide with the release of this parasite from red cells, and the red cells will break. And if enough of them break, hemoglobin is released and causes something called black water fever, where there's hemoglobin in the urine. So the reason we can't immunologically control this is this very devious organism keeps shifting its surface antigens. The surface of the cell will have components which our bodies will react to, will perform antibodies, but then the organism shifts it. It's like an individual who's constantly changing hats.
So if I survive an episode of malaria, it's still in my body and it might recur anywhere down the line?
Oftentimes people will clear the infection, but in the parts of Africa where malaria is endemic, the individuals will get reinfected again and again. And as they grow older, they become partially immune. They become resistant. And in Zambia, where Johns Hopkins Bloomberg has a field station at the Mission Hospital in Macha, it's believed the average 5-year-old will have had malaria, clinical malaria, at least 12 times.
Wow.
And with each time, there's a partial resistance, but it's not a complete resistance. It's not like if you have smallpox once or inoculated with a smallpox vaccine, you're forever protected. It's more like a cold or a flu, where this year's flu is related to last year's flu, but it's not exactly the same.
But the way that evolution has fought malaria is to develop sickle cell anemia, which is a pretty awful condition in its own right. But how does that prevent people from getting malaria?
So sickle cell anemia is the individual that is homozygous. It has the two mutant alleles. It does not make any normal adult hemoglobin. the carriers for this, of course, the mother and the father of a sickle patient are heterozygotes. They have one normal and one abnormal, and they're clinically normal. Yet the red cells have slightly shorter survival. And so sickle cell trait and sickle cell anemia is one of many different diseases of red cells, which are very prevalent in the malaria belt, the malaria belt being Africa and Southeast Asia in particular. And there are many other diseases of red cells that, while they cause some disadvantage to the individual, they do protect somewhat against malaria. And over thousands of years, any trait which confers some subtle advantage is passed along. Those people will survive, they'll have more children, and so on.
And then if they are in an area where there is no malaria, they suffer greatly from having sickle cell anemia.
Well, yeah, isn't that a crazy thing? Damned if you do and damned if you don't. The disease of sickle cell anemia is considerable, but the carriers, the sickle trait, are individuals who are clinically normal. Their red cells aren't perfectly normal, but they live normal lives. They're Olympic athletes with sickle trait who've won gold medals in Mexico City. So that is not itself a disease. So the carrier states are oftentimes not so severe. But given the other variations of red cell diseases, they do have negative consequences. But again, human evolution is a response to surviving malaria, which is a greater challenge.
My guests on Please Explain, which we're talking about malaria, Dr. Peter Agre, Nobel laureate and director of the Johns Hopkins Malaria Research Institute. Also, our mayor's name is attached to that research. And John MacArthur, chief executive officer and executive director of Millennium Promise. We will take a little break. When we come back, we invite your calls here at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Stay with us. And our number here on Please Explain is 212-433-9692. We're talking about malaria and related matters with John MacArthur, Chief Executive Officer and Executive Director of Millennium Promises, and Dr. Peter Agre, Nobel Laureate and Director of the Johns Hopkins Malaria Research Institute. John, what would a comprehensive solution to end malaria look like?
I think there's two pieces to this. One is ending malaria deaths, and the other is eradicating malaria as a disease. The latter, for all the reasons we've been talking about, is a complex issue. There's major research on vaccines. Dr. Agre is a world leader, of course, on that. And this is something where, over the space of 10 or 20 years, we hope to have a hopefully permanent solution. In the immediate term, there's a clear need to actually eliminate these needless deaths from malaria. So if we're losing 1 million lives a year is the best estimate, and there's estimates that maybe it's up to 2 or 3 million a year, one should be clear, because it's so hard, these places are so poor, just to measure exactly why so many children are dying.
So we want to clean up the places where the mosquitoes breed.
We want to clean up. We want to do a couple of things. We want to prevent as much of the transmission as possible. So try and break the transmission cycle. That includes a couple of things, two in particular. One is long-lasting insecticide-treated nets. This is a relatively new technology over the past decade, but a very simple one.
But you're sleeping under something that's laced with an insecticide? Is that good for your health?
There's no strong evidence. Dr. Agre might know the latest on this. There's no strong evidence I'm familiar with of adverse long-term health consequences, particularly compared to the health consequences of malaria. But these are very safe technologies. They last for 5 years. You basically have two people sleeping under a net for 5 years at a cost of $10. That's basically $1 per person per year. And we've seen that where these have been used in places like Ethiopia in the past couple of years, we've had 20 million odd nets distributed. Rwanda, 3 million nets. In Mali, 2 million nets distributed in 1 week in December of 2007. We're seeing that this is a major breakthrough type intervention, and there's been a commitment recently to Secretary General and UN leadership, and Ray Chambers, the Secretary General's Special Envoy for Malaria, have launched a major initiative to get every sleeping site in Africa under a bed net in the malaria endemic regions and the malaria affected regions by 2010. This means basically getting 250 million nets out. We're about 120 million short on the commitments right now, but we're seeing over the past 2 years in particular, since about early 2005, and then with action since 2006, literally tens of millions of nets are being distributed and used around Africa in a way that everyone just a few years ago thought was impossible. We can't overstate the importance of this. It's just one piece. The other piece, as we've talked about, is the spraying to make sure that we try and get the mosquitoes before they get to the net, or at least have the insecticide aspect outside of the net. But then the other is, for every child that gets sick, because nets themselves aren't complete solutions, they help decrease the transmission. They don't solve the transmission.
But you can't live under a net all your life.
No, but you sleep under it, and most of the biting happens, the infectious biting happens at nighttime while people are sleeping. But people do still get infected otherwise, for sure, and we need to make sure both the children and the adults are sleeping under the nets. There's been a real movement towards only children and pregnant mothers, but adult men carry malaria too. So we need universal access to these nets, but then we need the basic modern medicines. We used to use chloroquine. We used to use other medicines, SP and so forth. We should be using artemisinin and combination therapies. These are the modern frontline medicines, which cost about, $2.50 for a course of medicine. Utterly nothing for us, but impossible for a family with no money living on a subsistence farm in rural Africa. So subsidizing that treatment so that when a child or a person of any age does get malaria, they can get that load, the infection load down, get the disease under control and prevent those needless deaths in those cases we want to reduce, where people are actually still showing the adverse effects of the disease.
Before I get into how those medicines work, I thought I would bring in one of our listeners. Sarah from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I'm not a scientist, so I'm a little nervous and I'm a little overawed, but still, I have to speak up with the truth. I read about Professor Margolid of Israel in the 1992-1993, discovered a naturally occurring bacteria, BT1. It was used in China. It was used in the Sudan. It cleans out all the mosquitoes. There's no environmental damage to the flora or fauna. And in all these years, there's been no resistance to the mosquitoes. It does, I don't know if it kills the malaria itself or the babies, but it stops the breeding. It gets rid of all the malaria mosquitoes. Other mosquitoes too, river blindness and other diseases. Again, I say, a naturally occurring bacteria.
Okay, well, let me ask my guest. Peter, do you know about BT1?
Well, the idea of manipulating the mosquito population to reduce the prevalence of disease is a good one. The practicality, of course, is to eliminate mosquitoes is probably beyond what we can accomplish, whether it's with BT1 or with even insecticide spraying. The use of DDT, Mr. MacArthur mentioned earlier, was an effective way of dealing with malaria. It was used at very high toxic levels, and of course, with significant environmental consequences. And now, as he mentioned, with the residual spraying, we can protect people in the sleeping areas with small doses. But to get rid of all of the mosquitoes all the time is a difficult thing. And was mentioned, the disappearance of malaria from the United States coincided with rather low-tech but very effective methods, the development of draining ditches, building hoses, away from swampy areas, screens and the like. So to actually eliminate the anopheles species is probably a challenge, which could be achieved maybe in some small locale, but Africa is a big place.
Well, let's talk about some of the treatments. A listener asked about Nivequin, which he took but has caused tingling in his extremities. Is that no longer used?
Well, that's currently in the endemic areas. The artemisinin and combination therapies are found to be most effective. But malaria is very interesting. For a long time, quinine was used. This was from the bark of the cinchona tree in Peru, a folk medicine, which was effective. And in fact, at the time of the British Raj, if soldiers developed malaria, they were court-martialed because it meant that they were not taking their quinine. And of course, chloroquine and nivequin, these are all derivatives which have been effective for a while. But the organism develops a resistance, and this is the problem. And this is why, as significant as the inroads with the residual spraying and the provision of nets, we're going to need some new medicines because the organism is evading the standard medicines.
So why can't we come up with a vaccine?
Well, that's another approach and a very good question. And a lot of effort is being put into
I'm applying for a job at your research lab.
I'll send you an application. We'd love to have you here. So vaccine development would be great. If we could have a simple vaccine which provided total or near-total immunity, that would be a huge advantage. We could inoculate throughout the poorest of the poor regions. And the problem is the vaccines so far tested show some partial benefit, but not total. And as you recall, I think I mentioned earlier, individuals are oftentimes infected repeatedly. And with each infection, the severity of the infection may be somewhat diminished, but no one is ever totally resistant to malaria. And when someone from a malaria belt region leaves, maybe moves to the United States or Western Europe and returns after 6 months or a year, turns out they're more vulnerable, so the immunity is lost. So the idea of a vaccine is real. It may not be that it'll be a simple vaccine, and a lot of very bright people are working on that. We have people here at Johns Hopkins that are working very hard on that. But I think this is such an important disease, we need to have all of the approaches. And with the Institute like we have here and other laboratories, we're optimistic that somebody's going to make a big break.
But the feeling I'm getting from this conversation is malaria is tougher to combat than even HIV or tuberculosis.
Well, in some ways it is. Each of those three, you know, HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria, there are public health measures that could prevent the disease from occurring. HIV is quite clear. Needle exchange, unprotected sex. These are mechanisms that could prevent the disease from being passed along. But once it is passed along, then we need medicines. Same thing with TB, and particularly the drug-resistant TB. Public health measures, isolation of patients, making sure the patients take their medicines would lead to a disappearance of the disease. But when there's a relaxation, then the disease comes back. And with malaria, that's been the case. When DDT was banned, for environmental reasons and very important reasons, the mosquitoes had a heyday and the organism was passed around. And so it's much worse now than it has ever been in the history of the planet. And this has always been a big disease. It's believed that more than half of all human beings who ever lived died of malaria.
And if I could just add, though, I think that one of the things we have to keep in mind is how treatable and preventable this is. And the advent of antiretroviral therapy really made an enormous difference for the treatment of the AIDS pandemic around the world, especially post-1996, roughly. There was a takeoff in global attention for AIDS, not the least of which was because there was a mass mobilization in the rich countries because they had been suffering with this disease. Malaria has had a much more recent takeoff in public attention, and it's actually so cheap to tackle this problem and so practical. So it's the long-term disease burden, the science is, as Dr. Arger was saying, very complicated, but the actual control of the deaths from the disease, the ratio of effort to need has been so low, and we're finally catching up, and we could really nail this problem in the next 2 to 3 years.
Well, there's been a certain amount of resistance for cultural reasons to treatment to HIV for HIV/AIDS in some parts of the world. Not malaria? Are people very open to having it? What happens if you live in a very isolated rural area? Are you going to have access to these drugs?
Well, that's part of the major initiative right now is to get these drugs, and as we were saying, these artemisinin drugs, or ACTs as they're known for short, getting those to the clinic so that they're available and freely available.
And make them cheaper.
Cheaper or free. Because families, there's just too many stories, thousands and millions of stories of mothers and fathers carrying their children to the clinic, and then there's 5-10 miles, and then there's no medicine in the clinic because no one can afford to pay for it, and so the clinics aren't stocked. What we've seen with the bed nets in the past couple of years, and I lived through a lot of these debates in the earlier part of this decade where everyone was saying, oh, it's too hard, people won't value the nets unless they have to pay for them, and no nets were getting out, basically. The price kept cutting. Is it going to be $2? Is it going to be $1? Is it going to be 50 cents? And then we said, come on already, give them out for free. These are desperately poor people. They cannot afford to pay for it. And especially when there's returns to scale of everyone using the nets, and we really just need to have a very simple mechanism. That's what we're doing now for bed nets. We actually need a very similar approach, not a naive one, not a silly one from a pharmacological point of view, but getting the medicines available as well is a complementary piece of this strategy.
And John, thank you so much. John MacArthur is Chief Executive Officer and Executive Director of Millennium Promise. Dr. Peter Agre is the director of the Johns Hopkins Malaria Research Institute, and they have been our guests today on this segment of Please Explain, Dealing with Malaria. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.